Hi, I'm Michelle Henretti. Welcome to Sound Optometry, a podcast from Dockett that provides high-quality continuing professional development for GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, dockett.info. This month, we're looking at vision and driving. With the potential to have an impact on public safety, it is one of the most important areas for optometrists to get right. Just in the last few years, there have been a number of tragic cases which highlight how dangerous drivers with poor eyesight can be. In 2022, a man called Peter Westwell was hit and killed by an 81-year-old driver. The driver had been told not to drive 9 years earlier. By 2016, he had no vision in his right eye and very poor vision in his left eye. He failed to declare this to the DVLA when he reapplied for his licence. In another case, Marie Cunningham and Grace Faults, two friends who were just crossing the road, were struck and killed by a driver who was later found to be unable to see his own steering wheel clearly. And then there's Anne Ferguson, who was killed by a 72-year-old van driver with cataract in both eyes. A month before the incident, the driver had lied to his optometrist, claiming that he didn't drive. He failed to declare his sight issues on multiple licence applications to the DVLA. Overall, eyesight was recorded as the cause of 62 road deaths and more than 2,500 casualties between 2014 and 2023. And it's not just about what a patient can and can't see behind the wheel. Having a vision problem means that it might take someone longer to look at a road sign or change the radio station in their car. And all of this amounts to a greater risk of being distracted from the road. These worryingly high road safety figures are why the UK's government has been consulting on proposals to introduce mandatory eyesight testing for drivers aged 70 and over as part of their licence renewal process. The six-month public consultation has just come to an end, and road safety reforms could be implemented as soon as later in 2026. No matter how the system ends up being reformed, one thing is clear. Optometrists play a pivotal role in advising whether or not a patient is fit to drive. And with so many people relying on driving for their profession or their independence, it can be a particularly tricky topic to navigate in the consulting room. That's why, for this episode of Sound Optometry, we've enlisted the help of clinical advisors from both the College of Optometrists and the Association of Optometrists, or the AOP. They'll explain how to adequately communicate with patients whose vision may put themselves or others at risk if they were to carry on driving. We'll also cover best practice for record keeping to help protect you in the event of any disputes. So let's go ahead and meet our expert optometrist for this episode.
Hi, I'm Paramdeep Bilku. I'm a therapeutic optometrist and I'm a clinical advisor at the College of Optometrists.
Hi, my name is Aisha Patel and I'm one of the clinical advisors for the AOP.
So Aisha, Paramdeep, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you both on the podcast. Paramdeep, let's start with you. Firstly, as a reminder, what are the vision standards for driving?
Yes, so there are two elements to the vision standards for driving. The first one is checking your visual acuity, and that's measured in two ways, and they actually both need to be met. And that is a number plate test. That's when you stand 20 metres away and be able to read all the letters and numbers clearly. And then secondly, it's the Snellen test. You need to read the 612 line on the optometrist test chart.
So those are the two methods of vision assessment. And as you say, both standards need to be met because they're not equivalent to each other. And most optometrists will not have a number plate to test with or a 20 metre long testing room.
It's a good point because the number plate test in and of itself, we know is actually quite unreliable because patients aren't sure of the distance they need to stand when they carry it out. Sometimes the conditions could be overcast, it might be suboptimal. And also there's weather conditions that may be affecting it as well. For example, if it's foggy or if it's snowing or raining, you know, patients aren't quite sure about how to control the conditions to get a fair assessment. So they may overestimate or underestimate their ability. So that is why the number plate test is quite limited. And so by carrying out the Snellen test, we know that's carried out in a standardized way using an optometrist's test chart. It's illuminated appropriately and it has an objective clinician there to make sure that what you're reporting about your visual acuity is being recorded by a professional. Lastly, there's also the visual field element. So you need to have an adequate field, and it's generally accepted to mean a horizontal field of view of 120 degrees. and 20 degrees above and below that horizontal midsection.
And that's to make sure that they've got good peripheral vision for spotting hazards that may be causing a danger to them. And it's probably worth emphasising at this point that while many people do focus on visual acuity, the field of vision is a fundamental legal requirement for all UK drivers. So just to go over to Aisha, when would we go beyond the standard eye test to check visual fields?
So we recommend the optometrists undertake monocular visual fields based on the patient's signs and symptoms, and also when it's clinically indicated. For the purpose of a driver, visual fields should only be taken if the DVLA have requested this test. And in a situation where the DVLA have requested the test, the DVLA would need to assess the results. The reason for this is because the AOP are aware of several cases where members have become embroiled in disputes with the patient and the DVLA because of the results of the visual fields and the advice that the optometrists are given. Therefore, it's really important that if you are undertaking a binocular visual field test for the purpose of the DVLA, that you don't talk to the patient about the results and that you only do visual fields test when it's clinically indicated as part of the eye examination.
Yeah, just to come in on that, I think it's really important to set out there's a distinction to be made for carrying out a field test for a clinical reason versus one for a functional reason for an occupational task like driving. And so that wouldn't necessarily fall within the remit of GOSS or a sight test. That's certainly outside of it. So as I should set out, if you suspect there is a binocular field defect, you should refer them through the appropriate existing pathway for an accredited provider.
And Aisha, as optometrists, we can advise our patients not to drive, but it's always the patient's responsibility to inform the DVLA if they don't meet the standard themselves, isn't it?
Absolutely. If you have got a patient who you feel may not meet the visual requirements to be suitable for driving, then it's really important that they self-refer themselves on the Gov website, or there is also a paper V1 form which they can complete and it can be posted to the DVLA. Failure to report certain conditions, which are listed on the DVLA's website, can result in a fine for the patient of up to £1,000. Therefore, it's really important that the patient is aware if they do have a condition that does require reporting that they do so.
And Paramdeep, what are the other eye conditions which the DVLA need to be told about?
Yeah, so outside of not meeting the standards, if you have any eye condition that affects both eyes, or if you have one eye and it affects that eye, then you should notify the DVLA. But there are a set of specific notifiable eye conditions that you must report. And those are blepharospasm, diabetic retinopathy if you've had laser treatment, double vision, glaucoma if you have it in both eyes, nyctalopia or night blindness, and retinitis pigmentosa, whether that's in one eye or both eyes. Mm. So there are a range of conditions that if an optometrist detects them or a patient reports them, as a clinician, you should advise that they should be declaring that to the DVLA.
So apparently, part of the reason why we're discussing this topic is because a public consultation on drivers over the age of 70 has just concluded. Can you explain what that was and what might come of it?
Yes, so the government back in the early part of this year put out a proposal for an amendment to the Road Safety Bill, and that included a series of consultations, and one of them was to introduce mandatory eyesight testing for drivers over 70 as part of the renewal.
There is a lot of support for ensuring that older drivers do meet the standards. So why do you think that is? How much of a problem is it with older drivers?
So there is some research that shows there's a link between older drivers and the risk of road traffic accidents, particularly those which cause serious injury or fatalities, and that increases above people over 65. And there is some research that shows that older drivers are more likely to be involved in a road traffic accident due to their vision, because there's an age-related increase in the prevalence of eye disease as we get older. And there's not necessarily conditions which are sight-threatening, but also things like cataracts, they can lead to glare, and you're more likely to suffer that as you get older. And so those can impact your ability to see, affect your contrast sensitivity, and lead to potentially a road traffic accident. So yes, the risk increases as we get older. So that is why I believe the consultation was focused on that group.
And when we've done our research, we found a police study that stated that 77% of collision reports involving drivers over 60 listed uncorrected defective eyesight as a contributing factor. So that certainly does seem to be quite a good argument for focusing on that age group.
Yeah, it could just be something as simple as that they just literally didn't wear the glasses. And I often have patients that come into practice that they tell me that they've got glasses for driving, but I only put them on when I'm doing a long journey. And I have to make it really clear to them that every time you get behind the wheel, you must meet the standard every time. For example, you would never drink and drive over the limit, so why would you not be able to see and drive when you're under the limit?
Of course.
So this is why I think it's really important that we say as clinicians that it doesn't matter if it's a short journey, a route that you're familiar with, you're just going down the road, make sure you've got your glasses and you're wearing them, or have a spare pair in the car.
Aisha, in all age groups, how often are licences actually revoked because of vision issues?
Approximately 37,000 drivers have had their licence revoked or refused between 2022 and 2025.
And of course, as optometrists, we do quite often assess patients, and we know when we're assessing that actually they really shouldn't be driving. And I know that the AOP has looked into this. What were their findings?
Well, when we looked into this, we found that 56% of optometrists have reported to see a patient within just 1 month who continued to drive despite being told their vision fell below the legal standards. Now, a quarter of people say that they are concerned about a loved one or a family or friend who they know are driving despite having poor vision. And that's quite an alarming figure. And therefore, it really is important that we tell our patients, if they're not meeting the requirements to drive, that they do act promptly so that we can ensure that the relevant care is given to them to ensure that they are safe, not only to themselves, but to other road users as well.
I can see why the AOP and the college have issued a joint statement advocating for reforming the system. What do you think needs to change?
Yeah, I think the current self-declaration system is quite antiquated. I mean, across the whole of Europe, the UK is one of a handful of countries which rely on self-declaration alone. Many have an objective measure in place to ensure that people do meet the standards for their country. We've already talked about the limitations of the number plate test, and that if you don't attend for regular eye examinations, which are currently not mandatory, that you would never know that you have an eye problem. And so if you are asking people to self-declare that they meet the standard on the renewal form, although the vast majority of people are very honest and truthful, there's a risk that some people may not be so. And so it does open it up to potential abuse. And that was the case with the recent coroner's inquiry, which actually prompted the road safety bill to come out, actually, was that the coroner, Dr. Aidley, over a year and a half ago now, actually put a prevention of future deaths report in the public domain for the government to respond to, which set out that the current vision assessment for self-certification as part of the renewal system is insufficient, because there were drivers which were told that they didn't meet the vision standards and they carried on driving regardless, or they falsely declared that they could still meet them. And that results in the deaths of four people. Those were entirely preventable. And I think by introducing an objective system, patients and clinicians are protected. There's a formal system to ensure that the reporting goes direct to DVLA and it's provided for by an eye health professional. And that data is then validated and then checked. And then following that assessment by the DVLA, they can reissue or revoke a license on the basis of objective data.
So that's what the college and the AOP would like to change going forward. But of course, there hasn't been any reform to the system yet. So optometrists still need to follow the vision standards that were set in 1937. And so for the rest of the podcast, it would be useful for us to give listeners a bit of advice on the system as it stands today. In cases where optometrists know that a patient is likely to continue to drive, and we know they won't self-report to the DVLA, or they've told us that they're not going to self-report to the DVLA, what should we do? What can we do?
There is a real risk dilemma there because of patient confidentiality versus your obligation to keep the public safe. Now, the GOC Standards 14 does state that when a practitioner believes that a patient poses a very real risk to the road safety, but is unwilling or unable to notify the DVLA, the optometrist must consider notifying the agency without the patient's consent. Now, the most common legal risk in this regard is a scenario where the practitioner has told the patient not to drive, but then an accident has happened and it's caused a fatality. And therefore, you should always rely on the fact that if you are going to breach a patient's confidentiality and report to the DVLA, you must make sure the patient has given the opportunity to self-declare first.
Yes. Basically, you have to inform the patient and you have to record that you've informed the patient. But where you feel that the patient isn't going to do so, you inform the patient that you're going to notify the DVLA.
That's correct, yes.
I think in cases where it's really clear that they either will not or are unable to make a disclosure, then as a clinician, you also have a duty to protect the public. That's a reason enough on the balance of risks versus benefits to breach confidentiality and to make a direct disclosure. In those situations, you're protected as a clinician to do so. So people shouldn't feel reluctant to make a disclosure if they feel they have the evidence to support that.
The GAC have published guidance on confidentiality in driving, and a practitioner is unlikely to be criticising for reporting a driver, providing that they have given that driver the relevant opportunity to self-declare.
Yeah, so unless, as Aisha said, that you give them the opportunity and they don't follow it through, I think if it's very clear cut and they make it very clear to you that they're not going to do that, then there's a route to make a direct disclosure, and then that should be recorded on your records.
Have you dealt with any examples of this?
Yeah, so I've had several cases where I've actually made a direct disclosure. I've had people who don't have any glasses, they clearly fail the sight test, and they leave the practice, they get in the car and they go home. So I've got the evidence there to show that they are not following my advice. I had no problem at all ringing up the DVLA and making a disclosure. But clearly, as part of that process, you need to inform the driver that you're doing that. You may need to inform the GP or anybody else involved in their care as well, because there may be other issues that are affecting them, not just their eyesight. And also make sure you make a note of what you're doing as well. And there are other cases where people who say that they will disclose, but they're unable to. And so I then show them how to do that. And then I make a follow-up call a few weeks later just to ensure that they've done so. And that gives me the assurance that they've actually made the disclosure and I can update that on the record.
And Aisha, just thinking about the record card, making sure we have robust records, what do you think optometrists need to record when they are giving advice about driving?
It's really important that any advice given to the patient is clearly recorded on the clinical record card, including what's been said by the patient, any factual observations that you've made, and anything that the patient has said as well. So if the patient has said, actually, I only drive X number of miles a year, and therefore I don't need my glasses, or I only drive around the corner, it's really important that you've recorded any advice given and also any conversation that you've had with the patient as well. Now, if a practitioner is concerned that a patient is going to continue to drive against their advice, then what we would recommend is that a letter is sent to the patient by recorded delivery, and the OP has got a template of a letter that you can send on our website. Now, if the patient does continue to ignore the practitioner's request or advice to self-declare, then practitioners are most welcome to contact the AOP or the college, and they are able to discuss about the next steps about what to do. And we will talk about this on a case-by-case basis.
So, Parmjot, where are optometrists typically lacking in confidence in this area?
I think the challenge lies where there are borderline cases. For example, they're on the 6-12 line, they've missed a letter, or they're not quite sure. But as you set out, Michelle, it's not just that one standard, they need to meet both. And I think that's possibly where they need to be mindful of, that when they advise a patient they may not be able to drive, please check the number plate test as well. But I think there are two questions to ask yourself. Now, if you're unsure, if you're in doubt, let's say somebody's borderline or they just failed it, they're just below the standard. What would be the outcome of not reporting this or not recording it? What are the risks associated with doing that in the short and the long term? And then lastly, if I don't make the disclosure, how can I justify that? And whatever decision you make, that should be included on the record. But if you're in cases of doubt, that is where we encourage our listeners here to come and speak to professional advice, whether it's ourselves at the college or at the AOP. You can talk through that individual circumstances. We can support you in whether or not we believe that is a disclosure, or if it isn't, what actions that you should take.
And of course, you have to be confident that the patient is highly unlikely to meet the legal requirement for driving based on the evidence of your eye examination, because actually if a case is borderline and you're wrong and someone says that they had to stop work or they weren't able to do something because you told them they weren't able to drive, then obviously then that poses some risk to the practitioner. So we do have to be quite careful that we can advise the patient, but we can't actually tell them not to drive.
I think the other challenge comes out is, like, let's say they don't meet the vision standard, they need glasses to get that standard, they then purchase those glasses and then they leave your practice. I mean, you've got no control of whether or not they're going to wear them. It's along the similar lines of, like, using a seatbelt. We know it's a law, you must wear a seatbelt every time you drive. Equally, you must make sure you meet the standards every time you drive. But whether or not someone chooses to follow that through, I don't think it's something that the optometrist should feel that they're responsible for. So as long as you carry out your duty and you've recorded what you've done and you've carried out to your best ability and able to justify your decision, I think that's strength on the grounds enough to ensure that what you're deciding to do based on your judgment is the right thing.
Just thinking about telling a patient that they may not meet the legal requirement for driving or are unlikely to meet the legal requirement for driving, it is quite often bad news to patients. And in a previous episode of Sound Optometry, I did actually speak to Ian Trimmer, who is a social worker who specialises in this kind of communication. And at the time, I asked him to give us some top tips on how to deliver bad news. And if a patient didn't meet a vision standard for a particular reason, then how would we go about breaking that bad news to them? So I just wanted you to hear this conversation that I had with Ian Trimmer.
I've had numerous life-changing conversations with people, and the best outcomes have normally been when I've tried my best to make a connection with them, i.e. I've built some sort of relationship with them quite quickly from the get-go. There's quite a few different ways I kind of do that. One of the main ones is giving the impression of warmth, making that sure it comes through in your voice, in your body language, in your tone, speaking with that person with a level of enthusiasm, with them just wanting to be in your presence, a kindness, a friendliness, those types of things, really. And obviously, you have a level of professionalism along with that, too. So it's not over the top warmth, you know, hey, nice to see you. It's not that type of thing. But whatever you say needs to come from that place, if you like.
Yes. I think it's about being friendly and being approachable, because when patients feel comfortable, that's the first step, isn't it? When they feel comfortable in your presence, and then they start to trust what you're doing and what you're saying.
You hit the nail on the head. I think the warmth really helps with trust, absolutely, from the get-go. And trust is something you need when you're going to have a difficult conversation and break some bad news, because you want them to trust what you're saying. The other broad principle I would suggest is something which is often referred to as perspective taken, i.e. you're trying to see the world as someone else sees it. But within that is a key component of empathy. They may come in looking quite nervous, and you notice that. And then that's your cue really to help them feel more at ease. And funnily enough, warmth is one of those qualities that helps someone to feel at ease and building trust. When it comes to breaking that bad news, some people will display a range of emotions. So it might be anger, it might be disappointment, it might be denial, it might be shock, which is a normal reaction for some people to make. And you noticing that and also understanding that that's a normal reaction, along with not judging it, which is definitely a key component of empathy, allows you to build that connection with that person and have that conversation.
I mean, I can think of an example where they don't want to believe it. They're almost in that state of shock and disbelief. So quite often I will explain to the patient what the standard is. So for example, you need to be able to read this line on the vision chart, and you need to be able to read it. And by showing them, they know that actually it's not just a case of me communicating it badly and maybe there's some wriggle room. They actually understand why they don't meet the standard, if that makes sense.
That's actually perfect, Michelle. So when you're breaking bad news, if you can, try and prep them a little bit for that. And by you stating these are the standards that they kind of need to hit, you're kind of prepping them already. And then by pointing that out as well, like saying, this is the standard you hit and this is where you're at, that allows them to make that connection themselves. And it's always better for someone to come to that realization themselves when you're having these conversations. You know yourself, if any change needs to be made or any decisions that need to be made, if you've come to that decision yourself, you recognize that self, then that makes it easier for you.
If a patient is still struggling to come to terms with the bad news, is there anything that you can recommend that we can do as practitioners?
So what happens when someone hears bad news, it's likely to kick off their fight or flight response, i.e. their stress response. And when that happens, it's difficult for people to hear what you're saying. And they have even misinterpreted what you said that actually triggered that off. So what you kind of really want to do is clarify if someone's actually heard what you said correctly. So you may repeat it. You may say it in a different way. You may actually say out loud, I'm unsure if you've maybe picked that up correctly, whatever language you want to use. And then you maybe need to give them 30 seconds to a minute to absorb that information, because you want them in a position to then have that next conversation. And by checking in with them, maybe repeating it in a different way, you start to bring them back to the moment so they can hear things.
Because quite often when they've had time to process, they have additional questions.
Yes, we all do this. Whenever any of us struggle with some stress, our brains shut down to a degree. By putting these things in place, making these suggestions, you're helping the patient to start to not just hear, but make the next choices that they need to make and process it.
So Ian gave us that advice for when we're talking to a patient about not meeting vision standards for a specific profession. But can we transfer these top tips for when we are talking to regular driving license holders? Aisha?
Yeah, these top tips are really relevant. When we are breaking bad news to our patients and saying to them that they might not be legal to drive, sometimes that can be quite upsetting for them, especially when they think that they've come in for a routine eye examination and then we've asked them to rethink about whether they are able to drive or not.
So, Parandu, how can you ensure that a patient has understood the driving advice that you've given them? Because sometimes they nod and you think, they're not really listening.
I think that goes not just for driving advice, I think it's general advice as well. But what I like to think is I would never doubt the patient hasn't understood. But like you said, depending on their body language, the way that they respond to you, the non-verbal cues as well, that they may not fully understand it. So follow it up with written information. So give them a copy of the driving information leaflet that we provide as a college, and also the AOP that had their own leaflets as well, so they can turn back to it for the details.
Yes. And I found that when I've spoken to patients where their vision has been borderline, I always tell them that they do have to check the number plate test themselves and they can self-certify themselves to drive. But where I do sense a reluctance, I always explain, well, actually, it's not just about you being a safe driver. I'm sure you're a safe driver, but it's about whether or not you can spot the other bad driving out there. And sometimes that diffuses the situation a little bit and they laugh and say, oh, yes, that's true, because you want to be able to spot trouble when it's heading your way. And sometimes that's enough to make them think, well, actually, yes, it's not just about whether I'm going to harm someone else. I don't want anyone to harm me. So it's giving people the opportunity to reflect a little bit, isn't it, on the implication of driving with poor vision.
I think that's a really important comment and something to be mindful of, is that not just the impact that will have on others, but also the risk that other drivers who are in the similar situation onto them. And I believe that's the thing that changes behaviour as well. If that happened to me, how would I feel about it? Mm. And I think that's a really good example.
So we have actually covered off a huge amount today. But just to finish off, what are your top tips for optometrists when dealing with vision and driving? So if we go to Aisha first.
Thank you. So it's really important to communicate effectively with your patient. If they haven't heard what you've said, if they haven't digested the information that you've given, then the conversation in their eyes may not have happened. And it's really important also to record down any advice that you've given to your patient on your flip record card, and that using other forms of communication. So giving the patient a leaflet and just asking the patient to repeat what you've said or what the context of the conversation was, so that you can gauge their knowledge and understanding of what you've talked about.
I always feel a bit silly when I ask patients to repeat things. So quite often if they have someone with them, I get them to call the person into the room and say, oh, I've just been asked to bring you into the room. And I turn to the patient, would you like to explain what we've just been talking about? And that's quite a nice way of getting them to repeat it without feeling silly that you're asking them to repeat it.
Absolutely, yes. It's a good way, yeah.
And Parandu, do you have any other top tips?
Yeah, I think there are two things just left to think about. The first one is when you're attending for an examination, we're not there to catch you out. You know, we're there to support your eye health and make sure you see as clearly as possible. And so I like to see attending for regular sight tests for all drivers as something that's empowering. And if you explain that to your patient, that you're doing the right thing, coming in to make sure your eyes are checked, you can see clearly as possible. And if there is an eye problem, we can pick it up earlier. So if it does become an issue and need referral for treatment, or they need some further investigation, they're more likely to stay on the road for longer and be safer on the road for longer. So it shouldn't be seen as something that they're going to risk losing their license. It's just something that enables them to keep their license. So transforming that conversation is really important. And then lastly, we know that the DVLA website around what the conditions are does change. So make sure as clinicians that you keep abreast of that. So check that regularly so that if the list does get updated, you'll be able to keep on top of it. But as a professional bodies, as a college, as the AOP, wherever possible, if there is any update, we'll surely make that known to our members.
That point about not being there to catch patients out is important, isn't it? As you say, we're there to help patients get the correction they need so they can keep on driving. But in cases where that isn't possible, we don't actually make the final decision about whether or not a patient is allowed to drive, do we?
Yes. A lot of people are reluctant to tell the DVLA because they think their license is going to go straight away. And there's a distinction to be made between notification and revocation. So if you give them an assurance that, look, I have no power to take your license away, all I'm doing is encouraging you to report to DVLA, which is your duty, and then following some further investigations or some further checks, then you may continue to drive. It doesn't mean that you're going to stop driving. It just means that you may need to have some conditions on your license. You may need to undergo further testing, but the DVLA makes that decision. And so that can help to support building trust, because there's a risk there that if patients come to you and they fear that they're going to lose a license, they won't come to you again for their eye care, which can be really important. So having that trust there is really valuable.
And as you say, once you've built up that trust with patients that we're there to help them, if they do need to notify the DVLA, but are hesitant to do so, I think it's also worth noting what's at stake for them as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so if they have an accident, they could be prosecuted, and equally their insurance could be invalidated. So they really are taking a risk, not only to their own well-being in terms of being able to drive, but also to other road users as well.
That's a really important note to end on. Paramdeep, Aisha, thank you both very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for being here.
And thank you for listening. Don't forget that if you head to docket.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode, including where to find all the guidance from the college and the AOP. Finally, if you've got a topic in mind that you'd like us to cover, you can email us on podcast@docket.info or use LinkedIn to send us a message. There's a link in the podcast description. By completing the short exercise on our website, you can gain one CPD point covering professionalism and communication. We'll be back again next month, so make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so you don't miss out. But that's all from us for now. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.